This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're interested in Western movies or American history, I think you'll be very interested in the story my guest S.C. Gwynn is about to tell. His new book is about Quanah Parker, the last chief of the Comanches, which Gwynn describes as the most dominant and influential tribe in American history. Quanah's mother, Cynthia Ann Parker, was a white woman who was kidnapped by the Comanche when she was 9 in 1836 during a raid on her family's home in Texas. She became accepted by the Comanche as one of their own. When Quanah was 12, Cynthia Ann was recaptured by Texas Rangers, but she kept trying to return to the Comanches. The new book, Empire of the Summer Moon, tells the story of Quanah and his mother and tells the larger story of the rise and fall of the Comanches and how their dominance in the middle of North America determined how the American West was opened. S.C. Gwynn is a former senior editor at Time Magazine and former executive editor of Texas Monthly. He's now with the Dallas Morning News. Sam Gwynn, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's start with the story of how Quanah's mother was captured by the Comanche when she was 9. I mean, the family lived in a fort on the outer edge of white settlements about 90 miles from what is now Dallas. So they were very exposed. Why were they there?
They were part of that kind of vanguard of Scots-Irish settlement that really, you know, in effect was what eventually beat the Indians. But they were people who were determined. They were hard-nosed. They were predestinarian Baptists. And they settled, as you say, about 90 miles south of what is now Dallas. It was the outermost edge of the frontier. What they didn't know when they built their fort in 1836 was that it was right at the point where this giant 250,000 square mile Comanche empire touched this nascent American empire. They were exactly at that point. And so the Comanches raided the fort in May of 1836, killed a bunch of people, killed five people. There were a bunch of people wounded. Some escaped. But five captives were taken, and one of those captives was the 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, which became then in effect, the start of a 24-year-old captivity that she came to see not as captivity.
You describe very vividly what the raid, what the Comanche raid on the Parker Fort was like, and it's gruesome.
Extremely.
So I'm going to ask you to describe it, but first I'll say, if you don't want to hear a gruesome description, this is your opportunity to tune out for maybe two minutes. Come right back. But, I mean, this is history. So I think it's very important and interesting history. So please describe what happened.
Well, what happened was what happened in every Plains Indian raid going back for centuries. In other words, it was this is what Indians did to Indians, and this has just happened to be Indians meeting whites. But the automatic thing in battle is all the adult males would be killed. That was automatic. That's one of the reasons that Indians fought to the death. The white men were astonished at it, but they were assumed that they would be killed. Most of the small children were killed, very small children were killed. A lot of the, say, children in the, I don't know, 3 to 7 or 3 to 10 range were often taken as captives. The women were often raped and often killed. And so it was an extremely brutal, in other words, when all the people in the settlements back in those years knew what it was, knew what a Comanche raid meant, which was the same as a Kiowa raid or an Arapaho raid or another kind of raid. But they were grim, they were grisly, captives were usually involved, and it's an interesting kind of moral question that you have to, as an historian about Plains Indians or about American Indians in general, you have to come to terms with this, with torture, which they did, which they practiced all across the West, in fact, all across the East, and these kind of grisly practices that scared white people to death.
I mean, you're talking not only about scalping, you're talking about various forms of mutilation, cutting off fingers and toes,
Torture by fire, torture by all sorts of different things. I mean, putting, you know, hot coals on your stomach. And I mean, there were lots and lots of imaginative tortures that were indeed practiced by Indians all across the Americas.
And this includes gang rape. And what I find provocative about this right now is that an American's attempt to reconcile the atrocities that Americans committed against Native Americans. A lot of the Indian story was maybe rewritten a little bit to leave out some of those atrocities. I mean, focusing so much on, like,
yes,
you know, cowboys versus Indians in Western movies, I think so many Americans felt bad about that kind of, like, good guy versus bad guy description when white Americans were responsible for so much bad stuff themselves, that maybe... Are you suggesting in your book that history maybe got rewritten a little too much in terms of leaving out some of the atrocities Native Americans did commit in those wars?
I think that's a good point. And there was even an attempt at some point to deny that Indians were warlike. Comanches were incredibly warlike. They swept everyone off the southern plains. They nearly exterminated the Apaches. They were warlike by nature. And, you know, if you look at, say, the Comanches, and then you look back in history at, for example, you know, Goths or Vikings or Mongols or Celts, or old Celts are actually a very good parallel. In a lot of ways, I think we're looking back at earlier versions of ourselves. We being white Europeans, did all those things. Not only that, but torture was institutionalized in things like the Counter-Reformation and the Spanish Inquisition. It was part of the Russian Empire. I mean, torture is not the exclusive province of the Indians. But I think you're right. I think there was a certain wave of books, a certain type of book that wanted to kind of set the record straight in a different way. But yes, life was extremely brutal, and it was extremely brutal on both sides. And in my book, I try not to take sides. The whites were perpetrators of some of the most astonishing massacres in history, but so were the Indians.
So in this raid in which Cynthia Ann Parker was taken captive, how many people were killed and who was taken captive?
There were five people killed, and there were five captives taken. And the five captives were, there were two young adult women and three children, two boys, and then Cynthia Ann. So there were the five, and they were kind of strapped to horses and, you know, taken north into the vast, grassy wastes of the plains.
Why were the women taken and the children?
As it turns out, if you can sort of look back on what happened to them. One of the captives, Rachel Parker Plummer, who became very famous because she wrote a memoir of 15 months of captivity, she was actually kind of taken on as a what amounted to a slave. And Indians, Plains Indians, were buffalo-based, and they needed women actually to work buffalo hides. This was a part of the economy. So that's what Rachel did. Now, Elizabeth Kellogg, who was the other adult captive, was ransomed back within about 3 months. And that showed another way or another reason for taking a captive is there was a trade. There was a commerce in captives. The three younger children were actually adopted into the tribe, and this was a very common Comanche practice. The Comanches were had high mortality rates among the men and low fertility rates among the women, and they actually needed people. So they were more or less indiscriminate in who they took in. So there were Apache captives and Mexican captives and various types of captives that, you know, many of whom grew to become part of the Comanche tribe. Cynthia Ann was one of them. So she was a loved, what I call a loved captive. She had a family. She became the ward of a chief. She became a fully fledged member of the Comanche community.
So Cynthia Ann had three children, the oldest of which, Quanah, became one of the fiercest and most respected Comanche war chiefs. How did he become a warrior? I guess, are you automatically a warrior if you're a male Comanche in that period?
Oh, yes, you are. You were. The Comanches were kind of like the Spartans. They were, because of their incredible mastery, military mastery, which derived from the horse. They were the prototype horse tribe, the tribe that could do more with the horse than any other tribe could. Because of that, it was a military community, and their old way of life was supplanted by the new way of life, which was largely to do with war. So they pretty much hunted buffalo, and so a Comanche male would hunt buffalo and made war, and that's what they did. And they were remarkably stripped down in the sense that they didn't have elaborate social organization or religious organization. They didn't weave baskets or do art. They had a very, very elemental culture. And so within that culture, the boys learned to hunt and ride at a very early age, and then would become a warrior in their mid-teens. So he had kind of a normal rise, except that he was an exceptional warrior.
Now, did being half white affect his standing within the Comanche?
It did. Until he was 12, when his father was killed, an interesting event happened when Quanta was 12. Until that point, he was the son of a chief, a powerful chief who would have had many horses and would have been, you know, wealthy in Comanche terms. And then at the Battle of Peace River in 1860, when Cynthia Ann was recaptured, Quanta's father was killed. And now he was an orphan. His mother was back with white society, and his father was dead. And at that point, yes, he paid a price for having white blood. It probably stood him in good stead later in life in the reservation period, but then I think it was hard. And Quanta compensated for that, becoming probably the most capable warrior of his era.
Tell us the story of how Cynthia Ann was kidnapped back by white people in 1860 when Quanta was 12.
This was an amazing story. When she had to back up to when she was kidnapped in 1836, in the 1840s, she was spotted a few times, and each time she was spotted, the people that saw it were usually Indian agents, tried to negotiate to get her back. This was kind of a set piece on the frontier. You try to get the hostage, the captive back. When they figured out that she didn't want to come back, and she refused to come back. And this is the first kind of – her first fame was built on that. She was the white squaw who would not return. She sort of fades from memory in the 50s. She's no longer seen. Then in 1860, this extraordinary event happens. Her husband, Cynthia Ann's husband, Peter Nakona, is raiding just west of Fort Worth. He's leading these incredibly brutal raids that have a political purpose, which is basically to roll the frontier backward. They're so brutal that the white men kind of get a posse together under a guy named Sol Ross, who was later governor of Texas, under another guy named Charles Goodnight, who was one of the more famous cattlemen later in Texas. And they pursue the Indians back to what amounts to the camp where Cynthia Ann and her husband are. At that moment, most of the men were not at the camp, and so the Rangers attack and they kill everybody, including Quanta's father. And as Sol Ross literally is running down the last Indian and about to shoot, he realizes the Indian as a child, then realizes the Indian's a woman, and then realizes that the Indian has blue eyes. And lo and behold, soon enough, they realize that he's recaptured the famous Cynthia Ann Parker, who indeed then becomes famous again for having been recaptured. It was curious because the white men all thought that the tragedy of Cynthia Ann's life was that she had been captured the first time by the Indians. In fact, the great tragedy of her life was that she was captured the second time by the whites because she never adjusted. She tried to escape for the rest of her life and never adjusted. She had adapted once brilliantly to a foreign culture, but she couldn't do it twice.
So where did she live?
Well, after she was captured, the first thing that happened is they took her to Fort Worth and they literally put her up on a stand where people could come and gawk at her because she was such an object of curiosity. She had her 2-year-old, half white Indian child with her, Prairie Flower, and she ended up at the house of her uncle near Fort Worth, and she kept trying to escape. And she, mourned and she wept and she cut herself and she, she simply was a lot to handle. And so Isaac, that uncle, Isaac Parker, then moved her to another group of relatives and then on to and then she was eventually moved to another group of relatives deeper into East Texas, away from the plains. She was always a handful. She eventually kind of settled down a little bit, but she never stopped trying to escape.
You write about how Cynthia Parker's attempts to escape the white world after she was re-kidnapped into the white world kind of challenged all of the assumptions that white people had about Native American life.
That was one of the reasons I think, I guess the reason she was the most famous captive of her era was the refusal to come back first, therefore choosing this what the whites saw as kind of this subhuman, savage, civilization over the, Anglo-European civilization. There was that choice. And then when basically trying to get back was a reaffirmation of that same desire, that she didn't want to be with her own culture, if you will, or her birth culture. And yes, that was shocking. It was unusual. I mean, there are precedents for it. It did happen, but it didn't happen that often. And it really, if you have to go back and look at the way whites, particularly on the frontier, looked at Indians, they did not really regard them as fully human.
So when Quanah grew up and became a warrior, did he want revenge against the white people who had taken back his mother?
Yes, no one burned hotter than Quanah did. Quanah was Quanah later became, famous during the reservation period as a very wealthy and successful and influential Indian, but he never talked about what he did. We can sort of theorize the kind of raids he was on. We knew where the Comanches were raiding during the years when he was in his late teens and early 20s. The raids were particularly brutal. He was known as a brilliant fighter of both Indians and whites. He was someone who was never defeated in battle. It was sort of the source of his fame.
To give us a visual image of what Quanah looked like, I want you to read something from your book that is from the journal of someone from the army who fought against him. So granted, this is a very, very kind of biased description of him, because it's from an army person fighting against Quanah. But tell us who wrote this and then read the paragraph.
Okay, the account is from Robert Carter, who actually won the Medal of Honor for this fight against Quanah in 1871. And Carter wrote memoirs, a really extraordinary memoir, and it offers us one of the best looks at Quanah. This particular description comes from the Battle of Blanco Canyon, where Quanah did something that I don't know that there's any precedent for in military history, where Quanah, in effect, took an entire village of 200 lodges and hundreds of people and women and children and dogs and led it on an escape from 600 mounted bluecoats. It was a piece of military maneuvering. As I say, I don't think it's ever been done before. But anyway, this was the beginning. The beginning of that was sort of a battle. The beginning of that escape was a battle, and this is what Robert Carter is describing. He's describing actually Quanah just at the moment that Quanah blows the brains out of one of his sergeants. So here we go. A large and powerfully built chief led the bunch on a coal-black racing pony. Leaning forward upon his mane, his heels nervously working in the animal's side, with six-shooter poised in the air, he seemed the incarnation of savage, brutal joy. His face was smeared with black war paint, which gave his features a satanic look. A full-length headdress or war bonnet of eagle's feathers spreading out as he rode and descending from his forehead, overhead and back, to his pony's tail, almost swept the ground. Large brass hoops were in his ears. He was naked to the waist, wearing simply leggings, moccasins, and a breech clout. A necklace of bear's claws hung about his neck. Bells jingled as he rode at headlong speed, followed by the leading warriors, all eager to outstrip him in the race. It was Quanah, the principal war chief of the Quahadas.
So did Quanah go on raids? Did he lead raids on white settlements that were as brutal as the raid on his mother's family?
Absolutely. And you have to understand that raiding is what Mounted Plains Indians did. That was their, in effect, the Comanche way of life. They didn't really fight in a traditional way. They weren't, when they fought the white man, they did not usually, draw themselves up in ranks of 1,000 with gleaming spears against them and charge. That really didn't happen. Most of the warfare was what we would call sort of guerrilla warfare. These were attacks on ranches and things like that in settlements. So yes, this is what Quanah did. The idea was to improve your stock or increase your stock, get more horses, eventually also cows. The idea was also to get scalps, and simply the way of Comanche life. There was, a traditional, way of the raid was to go steal as many horses as you could and so forth. Eventually, it acquired more of a political cast. As the frontier swept westward through Texas, the Comanches at some point realized that there was more to raiding than simply stealing cattle. They were they were making a political statement. They were, in effect, you know, the more brutal the raids were, the more the frontier rolled backward.
Now, so you say between 1868 and 1881, 31 million buffalo were slaughtered, and that destroyed the source of Comanche wealth and food. So was that the downfall of the Comanche, the slaughtering
of
the buffalo?
It was pretty much, you know, the Plains Indians, their lives were built, the Comanches, their lives were built on two things, really. It was war and buffalo. And really all of the Plains Indians, once they got the horse from the Spanish, you know, buffalo hunting became easier for them. It was their way of life. The buffalo hunting began as a simple market exercise. I mean, the hunters figured out that they could get $3.50 a hide. Then they figured out that they could ship these hides east on the new railroads. And they also figured out that buffalo were not smart enough to realize that if a buffalo next to the buffalo dropped, that there was something wrong. The buffalo had to see the source of the danger, so that you had these people who killed like 3,500 buffalo in 28 days and crazy numbers like that. But it started that way, but it ended up being a political act, because the United States could have done something about that probably. But it occurred to the generals in the West, specifically Sherman and Sheridan, that by allowing the buffalo to be destroyed, they were creating kind of the most efficient way to destroy Indians. And Sheridan had a famous quote. He said, you know, you kill the buffalo, you destroy the Indians' commissary. So it became, in a way, political at the end. Yes, let's kill all the buffalo, and then it's the end of Plains Indians, because there is no Plains Indian without a buffalo.
So how did Quanah decide to give up fighting and settle for a land deal with the U.S. government?
Quanah, in 1875, after something called the Red River War, in which Quanah, again, miraculously evaded capture and didn't lose any battles, Quanah led the last of the Comanches who were starving, and of course they were starving because there was no buffalo, the last of the starving Comanches. They were the last ones to surrender in 1875. They came onto a reservation in Oklahoma. Quanah, who had been, as I said before, like the hardest of the hard cases, the one who burned hottest for revenge against the whites, had sort of a revelation. His family lore says it was a vision that with a wolf and an eagle in it, but something happened and changed, and he decided he would walk the white man's road, and he decided it as he was coming into the reservation.
What do you mean, walk the white man's road?
Well, he would become, in fact, you know, Quanah, the notion seems almost ridiculous of a bourgeois kind of Comanche, citizen Comanche, but that's what Quanah wanted to be. Quanah was going to walk the white man's road. In other words, try to learn the language, try to understand white man's business. He actually turned out to be a brilliant businessman, controlled a small cattle empire, outfoxed the whites at their own cattle leasing games. Actually ran these kind of protection rackets for a while. He was actually a brilliant businessman, but he just figured he would adapt, and he would try to help his tribe adapt. And of all the Indians in the reservation period, he was the wealthiest and most influential. And he became a friend of Teddy Roosevelt and rode in his inaugural parade and so forth.
So during this period, was he not only aware, but did he make other people aware that he was half white? Did he use that to work in his favor when trying to deal with white people?
Everybody knew. That became known right after Quanah surrendered. He went into the commandant at Fort Sill, and he told him, because what Quanah wanted to know was what had happened to his mother. Quanah's first question was, what happened to my mother? And that's how, in other words, as soon as that happened, everybody found out. A book was written a few years later that, if anybody did not know then, they learned who this guy was.
And what had happened to his mother? Was she already dead?
Cynthia Ann leads this kind of miserable life, shuffled off to, you know, one Parker relative after another, pretty miserable. In 1864, she lost her daughter to influenza, this lovely little girl named Prairie Flower. In 1870, she herself died, and it's not exactly clear how or why. Some said she starved herself to death. Some people said she died of a broken heart. But either way, she never adapted. So that it was a tragedy, I guess part of that family tragedy, that Cynthia Ann died in 1870, and her son Quanah did not come into surrender until 1875. So he never saw his mother again, although he spent enormous efforts trying to find her and eventually did find her and eventually got the government to pay to ship her bones up to lie with his in Oklahoma.
So how do you see American history differently as a result of researching this book?
To me, the original reason I was interested was because it provided, the Comanches were kind of a history lesson. They were sort of, here is how and why the middle of the country opened to white civilization. If you go back through Comanche history, you can see that they were, you know, they were the ones who stopped the Spanish from coming north. They're the answer to that question. Why did the French stop coming west from Louisiana? Comanches. It was fear of the Comanches that caused the Mexicans to bring white Texas settlers into Texas, you know, to create a buffer between them and the Comanches, which eventually backfired. And, of course, Texas became a republic, and things like the Alamo and San Jacinto happened. I mean, they account for, you know, the Rangers and the Six Gun and so many different things. And to me, what I understood, what I came away understanding from the Comanches was that here is why the West Coast and the East Coast settled before the middle of the continent did. Here is why there was this enormous, basically 40-year wait before you could develop the state of Texas or before other plain states could be developed. So it was kind of a great history lesson in how America settled itself, I guess.
Sam Gwynn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
S.C. Gwynn is the author of the new book, Empire of the Summer Moon. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Buzz Bissinger's nonfiction book, Friday Night Lights, is about a high school football team in Texas, and it was the inspiration for a 2004 movie and a current TV series. In both the movie and the NBC drama, the coach's wife is played by the same actress, our guest, Connie Britton. Her first film role was in 1994's The Brothers McMullen, and her early TV roles included starring opposite Michael J. Fox in the sitcom Spin City and playing small recurring roles on The West Wing and 24. NBC's Friday Night Lights almost was canceled after 3 seasons, but a co-production deal with satellite network DirecTV kept it alive for 2 more years. DirecTV subscribers have seen all of Season 4 already, but on NBC, Season 4 is about halfway through. This season finds Coach Taylor struggling to put together a team at East Dillon High in the poorer part of town. He's been transferred there after a power struggle with the boosters of West Dillon High, where he had been coach of the champion team, the Panthers. Connie Britton's Tammy Taylor is the principal at West Dillon. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke with Connie Britton and began by playing a scene featuring her as Tammy Taylor and Kyle Chandler as her husband, Eric. He's just come home a little drunk and with a big admission.
I stopped over at the bar and I had a drink and I left the car over there. Alan gave me a ride home, so if you could take me to get in there,
right.
I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
You know that check yesterday you asked me about, the check for the dry cleaners?
Yeah.
It wasn't for the dry cleaners. It wasn't for $45. It was for Under Armour. It was for gear for the team. And it was for $3,000.
You wrote a check for $3,000? We don't have $3,000 in our checking account.
I know that. But when I wrote the check, it's not a check that's going to be run through right away. So you don't have to worry about it.
Well, I really would have appreciated if you'd have talked to
me
about
this. Well, I
didn't
have time to talk to you
about it. You didn't have time to talk to me about it?
No, I didn't have time to talk to you about it. I'm telling you about it now.
Listen, I know you're having a hard time, but come on now. Why would you not talk to me about that?
Listen, if I don't write the check, I don't have uniforms for the team. If I don't have a team, I don't make money anyway, so what the hell does it matter? If I can get the money from Burnwell, who I've been talking to, which I think I can do, everything will be fine. It's just a matter of doing it. I just need time. I'm just telling you for the sake
of
not...
Don't raise your voice.
I'm not raising my voice. Why don't you just stay calm and stop getting all riled up?
Okay, you're going to get your damn uniforms, but in the meantime, what about our accounts? You write yourself a check for $3,000 without talking to me about it. You lie to me about it. We don't have that money. And then you come in here and you yell at me? I don't think so.
Connie Britton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
Your character's relationship with the members of your TV family, your husband and your daughter, is one of the best in all of television. And I just love the tone of that. What's your reaction to hearing it back?
It's also, you know, whatever. We all love our show so much. It's crazy. We're just all goofy about it. You know, We had some problems with that scene when we went to shoot it because it was written much more where Tammy is just kind of like, all right, honey, I understand. You're going through a hard time. Sorry. It's a hard time. And meanwhile, she in that episode is also going through, you know, basically being ostracized by the whole town and whatnot and all this stuff. So they're both going through it. And so we kind of both felt like, well, trying to get to the heart of the reality of it, we wanted to just kind of create it into this little bit of a mess of an argument and have him cop to it. And then he's drunk and I'm pissed and tired and not really let it have a resolution, you know, and then see where we go from there. And, you know, we end up having conversations like, would they go to bed mad, you know, stuff like that. And that scene's a great example of how we can really mold the stuff that the writers give us, and they give us that freedom to do that and find something that feels really alive in the moments that we're shooting it.
Many people watching the show have admired the marriage between your characters, or maybe even aspired to the marriage. How do you see that marriage, and what do you hope to convey about it?
Well, you know, it's been an exploration for both of us, and I've certainly learned a lot from Kyle because he has been married for a long time, and I think he brought a lot of that to this relationship, and I really agreed about the values of the marriage and of what we were trying to create. You know, we both agreed we did not want this to be a marriage where we were going to be ultimately addressing, you know, infidelity or whatever. We really wanted to deal with the authenticity of what it is to try to make a marriage work. And sure, there's an immediate dramatic effect of, you know, somebody going off and having an affair, but I still maintain that the drama of two people really trying to be in a relationship with each other that is, you know, nourishing and supportive is pretty great drama.
And it's not only husband-wife, but it's parents and daughter. So far, this next scene is, I think, my favorite scene from the entire show. And it's after, I don't know where you rank it, but it's after your character sees your daughter's boyfriend, Matt Sarrazin, buying condoms. And you pull your daughter aside to talk to her about it. And we have, this is you in the scene along with Amy T. Garden, who plays Julie. Here we go.
Are you and Matt Sarrazin having sex?
No. We're thinking about it.
You're thinking about it. Are you thinking about pregnancy? Are you thinking about sexually transmitted diseases?
Well, I mean, obviously, that's why he's buying condoms.
Oh, I see. So you're just buying condoms, and then when you buy condoms, that just makes you ready to make love to somebody, anybody.
Making love.
Don't do that. Don't you smirk at me right now. I am very upset. You are not allowed to have sex. You're 15 years old!
I don't see what the big deal. It's just one body part going into
another. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's not just one body part going into another body part. And the fact that you think that it's just one body part going into another body part makes me real clear on the fact that you really are not ready for this. And I need you to be able to hear that. I need you to be able to hear me say that to you.
I'm listening to you.
Let me tell you what the big deal is. Let me tell you what can happen. What can happen is that you can be hurt. And you can be degraded. And you can become hard and you can become cynical. And I don't want that to happen to you. This is something that's special. It's something that's meant for people who are in love.
Okay, I understand.
And you can wait. I want you to be able to talk to me about it.
Okay, I mean, we're talking, right?
That is such a wonderful scene.
Thank you.
The intensity and the honesty of it. How do you get there as an actress? What can you tell me about filming that scene?
Well, you know, this would be a good time to talk about the general process of our show, because we shoot with three cameras going all the time,
mm-hmm.
Which is very unusual. Most film and television shoots with one camera, and so you keep shooting a scene over and over again. We shoot with three cameras, so they're always getting different. They're always getting different angles. So there's a lot, and we never know where the cameras are. We don't rehearse. They don't tell us where to stand, which is what you call having marks. We don't mm-hmm. have marks. So there's a real freedom in it. And it's interesting when you just played that. I heard one of my favorite lines in that scene is the line where I say, you're not old enough to have – you're not allowed to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as if a mother is allowed to tell – can forbid her daughter from having sex, you know. And in the script – That line was in the script, and I remember it was written a little differently in the script, and it was written almost in a – not in a joking way, but almost to, you know, have Tammy look like she's kind of pulling her hair out, like, you're not allowed to have sex, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But because of the way we shoot, and then we had this great director, Allison Liddy Brown, was shooting that episode, and – I think she had told Amy T. Garden, who plays Julie, to laugh at me or something, you know, and that really got my goat, you know. So suddenly it went in this whole different direction, and because we had the freedom to do that, we weren't being concerned about where the camera was, where the lights were, where our marks were supposed to be, when we were supposed to say what, at, you know, if there was going to be a camera on us or not, which is a lot of the time what you end up being concerned about when you're shooting TV. So we really just had the freedom to be in that in those moments and just play it out, and so it ended up being a real dramatic thing. And the other thing is I noticed too is the silences, you know, and
yes,
we play a lot with silence in our show. There's room to have those silent moments. We don't have to fill it all with chatter all the time, and I think there's a lot that gets said during those silences.
We've played a scene with you, with your family. I'd like to play one more scene. You know, your character began as a guidance counselor and then became principal of Dillon School and got into a lot of hot water there. And so this is a scene where when you are the school principal of Dillon, you're pushing through the transfer of a star football player to a smaller rival school where your husband now coaches. And one of the Dillon Panther boosters has threatened action if Tammy goes through with it. So you bust in on the next meeting of the Booster Association and confront him, knowing full well that everyone else who's also a booster is eavesdropping with great interest. So here we go.
And then, buddy, are we looking to talk to that
Sorry, I hate to interrupt. How are you? Good to see you, Sam. Don't mean to interrupt. I just, can I just have a quick word with you, Joe?
Go talk amongst yourselves. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have any misunderstanding the other day when we had that conversation in the school parking lot, you know, mm-hmm. with the golf cart, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure I was clear that my decision has been made and is made, and that Luke Cafferty is going to East Dillon High.
Are you clear about what I told you?
Oh, yeah, I think I heard you. You mean about doing an investigation and retroactively taking away Panther state titles? That's the thing you're talking about? Because I just want to actually make sure that you also checked with all these gentlemen here about that, because, as you said, you know, that's going to mean rings being taken away and things like that, and I can bet you there are a lot of rings in this group, you know, family and whatnot. So, you know, you do what you have to do. I know you're going to do what you have to do, but I just want to make sure I had been very clear with you where I stand on it. So I'll let y'all get back to it. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Y'all enjoy.
The booster clip, you know, illustrates such a forceful, charming Southern woman where you go in seemingly unarmed, but you're the equal of not only anyone in there, but everyone in there. And, mm-hmm. you know, where does that come from, or how much fun is that to play?
So much fun, and all I know is I know that that quality so well that I'm sure I probably have a little bit of it myself. they were tough broads. My mother would march herself up to our school and have it out if she thought we weren't getting, you know, if they she thought they were screwing up in something that we were, you know, some class or something. Mm-hmm. She was like a mother bear. And a lot, you know, these were not women who were just going to sit back and say yes, sir, no, sir. You know, they... But they were sweet because they knew that that's what they had to do to get their point across in that sort of environment. It's a real interesting thing that happens, I think, to and just speaking really generally to women who are in an environment that is considered to be kind of conventional, and that is that they find ways, real subtle ways and personality ways, to break out of that or to empower themselves in the face of that. You know, I think that that was a lot of it too.
Is it too Freudian to ask if you got influenced or inspired by your own mother?
I was, for sure. Yeah, and actually, strangely, my mother actually was from Connecticut, but we lived a good part of, I mean, most of my life in Virginia, and she lived the last part of her, last half of her life. She passed away, actually, a couple years ago, in Virginia, and so, and she really took it on, you know. But she really adapted to the Southern world, and so I felt that she there are a lot of things that I take from her in the character as well. Yeah, and actually, you know what? The truth, the timing wise, she passed away right before we started shooting Friday Night Lights. So I, you know, I've never really thought of this actually until you just asked the question, but I realized being home during that period specifically and seeing, you know, the casseroles and the brownies and the cookies that ended up on the front porch daily and the organization mm-hmm. of the neighbors and the people and how they were going to come together for the family. And, so I actually think that that experience in particular, in a more fresh way, and being able to be around all those women and then all my high school friends who, of course, all came back and gathered around me, I think really contributed to the character.
It actually makes, you know, Tammy sort of, in one small respect, a way of keeping your mom alive if you started the series uh-huh. right after that.
Yeah, yeah.
So have you ever gotten coached on your accent or corrected for your accent? Or how does that work behind the scene? How'd you nail that?
I have not been coached. You know, I think I'm lucky because I think I have a pretty good ear. And again, being in Austin helps so much. There was one time that I had to say the word pecan. And everybody, and see, these are my coaches, everybody in the crew, they were like, I said it wrong. And by the way, mm-hmm. I can't tell you if it's pecan or yeah. pecan, which I still right at this moment can't tell you because I kept doing it wrong. And first they laughed at me. And then they said, they kept correcting me over and over again. And I think we may have gotten one take where I actually said it properly in the correct Texas way. But that was tricky.
You couldn't just change it to a different kind of pie?
Oh, gosh, that would have been real smart, wouldn't it have been?
Well, it depends. Yeah, no, I don't know how much money they're spending, but you know, four or five takes in, it could have been a pumpkin pie.
No, in fact, you're right, though. The thing, now that you say that, we had pecan pie. That's what we had, and that's all we had to just, you know, if we could have made it, you know, lemon meringue, it would have made things a lot simpler.
But I guess if it was the only thing on set,
yep,
that's
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
As we speak, NBC is midway through broadcasting season 4, while you're in Texas, if I'm right, filming the final episodes of season 5.
That is right.
Okay. Word is they're intended as a probable finale, but ABC Family has recently acquired rerun rights for the first 5 seasons, and it's not inconceivable they may want more. Is there any chance of a season 6, or do you sense the end is near?
Oh, gosh. I have never in the history of our show felt more confident that the end is near than I do now as we are about to embark on episode 10 of season 5.
And these, you know, are 13?
It's 10 out of 13, okay. Exactly. And I actually just read that episode this morning and actually got a little teary because I thought, wow, this does feel like we were ramping up to the end. Everybody is saying that season 5 will be our last. And that said, because of the history of the show, I would not be surprised if suddenly in the 11th hour we were suddenly hearing about a sixth season.
Well, best of luck with whatever is next, and thank you so much for some really great years of television. So, Connie Britton, thank you so much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Connie Britton spoke with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. She co-stars on NBC's Friday Night Lights. I'm Terry Gross.